This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 20th of December, 2006. From KPFK in LA, this is Aura Bogado. As the violence rages on in Iraq, President Bush hints at adding U.S. troops in an effort to secure Baghdad. The FCC considers loosening restrictions on telephone companies to provide cable TV in local markets. And we'll hear from Mogadishu, where the Council of Islamic Courts and the interim Somali government are bracing for war. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. As gun battles between factions rage on in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli army continues to carry out raids in several West Bank cities. Manar Jibreen reports.
The Israeli army invaded the West Bank village of Silat al-Harithiyah near Jenin before dawn today, backed by at least 20 armored vehicles and air cover. Soldiers broke into several homes and surrounded and partially demolished one of them. Two Al-Quds Brigade fighters were killed by Israeli gunfire. In separate incident, a 13-year-old girl died today after Israeli soldiers shot her yesterday as she passed by a section of the separation wall near a West Bank village near Tul Karem. Since Saturday, the Israeli army has killed 7 West Bank Palestinians. Soldiers also abducted 22 Palestinians during sweeps carried out today in several West Bank cities. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibreen.
An Indian province has made HIV/AIDS tests mandatory for couples before marriage. Binu Alex reports.
The provincial government of Andhra Pradesh in India says a new law will make it compulsory for couples to take an HIV test before marriage. Activists say this may face a lot of flak from common people, but still could revolutionize the awareness of the virus in the country, which according to UN has the world's highest number of HIV infections. The provincial health minister says the results of the test will not be publicized, although it's not clear how the new requirement will be enforced and what the state government intends to do with the information it gathers. The province, which has a population of 78 million, has an estimated 1 million infected with HIV. Almost all of the political parties support the new legislation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Binu Alex.
Members of the Mexican army and police continue to carry out a joint operation in the Pacific state of Michoacán. Under the banner of fighting the war on drugs, police and soldiers have been working together as part of a pilot project to create a national security system in Mexico. Vladimir Flores reports from Mexico City.
Mexican President Felipe Calderón has stated that the country's civilian police must work with the armed forces to combat organized crime and drug trafficking. The president justified the presence of more than 7,000 soldiers, marines, and police agents in Michoacán during yesterday's presentation of the operation's preliminary results. The joint operation includes the construction and staffing of checkpoints on highways and roads, patrols of urban areas and ports, and helicopter overflights of mountainous regions. But Operation Michoacán has not stopped violence caused by organized crime. This week alone, 4 people were killed in supposedly drug-related violence. One of the bodies was found in the town of Apatzingan, where the operation is based. The governments of the states that border Michoacán have announced plans to set up checkpoints along state lines in an effort to contain the violence. The federal government has suggested that the joint military police operation could extend to other parts of the country. In Mexico City, Vladimir Flores for Free Speech Radio News.
In Argentina, thousands marched to the Plaza de Mayo today to mark the 5th anniversary of a popular uprising that swept away the government. Remember the 33 killed on December 20th of 2001 and call for an end to impunity for military and police officers involved in politically motivated violence. Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
5 years after Argentina's worst economic crisis, groups commemorated the popular protests and demanded that the government find Julio López, a missing 77-year-old witness whose gripping testimony of torture helped convict a former police officer in a landmark junta trial. During the rally in front of the presidential residence, unionists, human rights organizations, and members of the unemployed workers' movements called for an end to impunity for military officers who led systematic torture and disappearances of dissidents during the 1976-83 dictatorship, as well as so-called easy-trigger police officers who have killed at least 2,000 people since the return to constitutional democracy. Masses of people swept the streets December 19th and 20th, 2001, with the slogan, Que se vayan todos, all of them out. 2 days of rebellion and imposed state of siege ended with 33 deaths and 200 injured. Over the holiday weekend, relatives and groups will camp out in Plaza de Mayo as part of an awareness campaign called Christmas Without Disappeared. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush held what will most likely be his last news conference of the year. The topic of interest, Iraq. Bush is in the process of deciding U.S. military policy in Iraq and has said that he's considering adding more troops in an effort to secure Baghdad. At today's press conference, he denied that any decision has been made.
Well, I haven't made up my mind yet about more troops. I'm listening to our commanders. I'm listening to the Joint Chiefs, of course. I'm listening to people in and out of government. I'm listening to the folks on the Baker-Hamilton Commission about coming up with a strategy that helps us achieve our objective.
But he has made up his mind about wanting a larger military in general. Bush asked new Secretary of State Robert Gates to come up with a plan to increase the human capacity of the military. And as Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, a larger military could be a possibility since Democrats, who will take control of Congress come January, are also in favor of the increase.
President Bush asked Secretary of Defense Gates to look beyond Iraq.
I'm inclined to believe that we need to increase in the permanent size of both the United States Army and the United States Marines. I've asked Secretary Gates to determine how such an increase could take place and report back to me as quickly as possible.
The president's call for an expanded military is separate from his support for deploying more troops to Baghdad. Gates, while meeting with military leaders in Baghdad, acknowledged that he is exploring a military expansion. The Army currently has about 480,000 combat-ready troops.
The question is, what's the mission? What's the purpose? Can we do this? How big should an increase be? And then there's always the question of how big an increase can we afford?
The president's call to build up the military is a shift in administration policy. Former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld advocated transforming the military to a more streamlined approach, to rely more on technology and less on human capability. Despite administration objections, Congress authorized the temporary addition of 30,000 active duty troops last year. The administration opposed the increase, largely because of costs. In an executive statement the administration wrote in June of 2006, they said it would require the Department of Defense to maintain more people than they thought necessary. The price tag for military personnel is high. Every additional 10,000 troops cost about $1 billion. Dennis McDonough is senior policy fellow at the Center for American Progress. He says investments in troops don't stop after they return from combat.
They continue long after they return from their service overseas and in the form of increased hospitalization or medical care, in the form of support for the dramatic increase in the number of troops are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder.
The United States has the largest defense budget in the world, more than the next 14 biggest spenders combined. Last year's Defense Department was funded at $387 billion. That's not including the major costs of war. Iraq and Afghanistan have cost almost $500 billion since the wars began. With Democrats taking control of Congress in January, a larger military is possible. Senate Democrats, following the lead of Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, have been calling for an expanded military. Senator John Kerry called for a bigger military in his 2004 presidential campaign. And this past September, Democrats introduced the Real Security Act, which called for more special operation forces. In a news conference yesterday, incoming chair of the House Armed Services Committee Ike Skelton once again renewed pleas for a larger active duty military. He said the U.S. military is in dire straits.
When you see people being extended, when you see brigades being sent over early, if you want to measure the stretch and strain on these young people, talk to some of the spouses and their children, and you will notice. I'm very concerned about it, but I worry about at some point you're going to break these forces.
Skelton acknowledged that funding the wars, a larger military, and domestic programs will be difficult.
We're going to have some real budget challenges.
Congress can expect to receive another supplemental for the wars at the beginning of the year. This time, it'll cost $100 billion. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The five members of the Federal Communications Commission met in D.C. today to decide on a new rule proposed by FCC Chair Kevin Martin that would loosen restrictions on telephone companies seeking to provide cable television services in local markets. Chairman Martin, a Bush appointee, has argued that the rule change would give greater choice to local communities, but consumer groups say it would take decision-making power away from the communities the rule is supposed to benefit. FSRN's Darby Hickey has more.
If you travel through the nation's capital, the rival signs of cable and television industry groups are ubiquitous, alternately trumpeting the quality of cable television or criticizing a lack of choices for consumers. These ads, in subways, newspapers, on television and elsewhere, are the most visible sign of the fight by telephone companies, led by AT&T and Verizon, to gain greater unfettered access to local television markets. At present, companies seeking new franchises in a local market must negotiate with municipal or city authorities to determine the exact terms of the company's provision of cable television services. But this current process is too onerous, say telephone industry groups like TV for Us, a coalition whose goal is new choices, better services, and lower costs for television, according to its website. Federal Communications Commission Chair Kevin Martin agrees and proposed the rule change approved by the commission today.
By enhancing the ability of new entrants to provide video services, then, we are advancing our goal of universal, affordable broadband access for Americans, as well as our goal of increased video competition. I am also committed to seeing that consumers are able to realize the benefits of competition in the forms of better services and lower prices. But as was just demonstrated in our annual price survey, cable competition can make a difference and can impact cable bills.
Democrat Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein argued against the rule change, citing infringement on local authorities' power.
I think it's really also critical for the future of democracy that Americans have access to as many forms of video content as possible so that they can make up their own minds about the issues of the day and not remain subject to a tiny number of gatekeepers who can decide what deserves airing based on their own financial or ideological interests. My fundamental concern with this order is that it's based on such a paper-thin jurisdiction, but is so breathtaking in its scope. Sum total here is an arrogant case of federal power riding roughshod over local governments.
The major issue at stake with the rule change include a proposal to force localities to make a deal with telephone companies that already own the relevant public rights of way within 90 days, after which the companies would automatically get access to the market. Additionally, the rule change seeks to limit what local governments can force companies to provide as additional benefits to the community on top of a preset fee, and companies would not have any obligation to offer services to everyone in the geographic area of the franchise, which would result in the services being provided selectively to well-off neighborhoods, says Franny Wellings, Associate Policy Director of Free Press.
We actually do need to give the public more choices here, and we actually do need more public involvement. And what we generally support is the local level authority, so that the public can be involved when the franchising authority is local, and the public can go to the local authority and say, cable rates are too high, I'm not getting service, I've got some horrible box in my front yard from the phone company, you know, things like this. But they are trying to get around those agreements. So what we need is for the public to be more involved, to be vigilant.
Local governments are also concerned about the rule because it would take away much of their decision-making power, according to the National League of Cities. The current structure may not be perfect, but it does give local communities greater involvement with telecommunications companies' actions, says Skip Kelly, executive director of the Telecommunications Advocacy Project, which lobbies for quality telecommunications services for low-income and underserved communities.
We do not want any diminishing of that authority on the part of local governments, because local governments are more directly involved with the needs of their constituents. And in many cases, local governments are run by African Americans, Latinos, and other minorities, and this is where the concentration of political power is for people of color.
Although the telephone companies succeeded in getting legislation with similar intent passed through the House of Representatives this year, it did not clear the Senate. Kelly says Democrats in control of Congress will likely rescind the FCC's decision and seek to pass their own legislation. Additionally, there will likely be lawsuits over the rule change, predicts Franny Wellings of Free Press, suggesting that telephone companies will refocus their efforts on changing laws at the state level. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Tensions remain high as both sides of Somalia's civil conflict, the Council of Islamic Courts, or ICU, and the interim Somali government are preparing for a possible war. A 7-day deadline issued by the ICU for the government to withdraw what they say are Ethiopian troops from Baidabo, where the beleaguered transitional government is housed, has passed. Abdurrahman Warsame has more from Mogadishu.
As Tuesday's deadline for the withdrawal of Ethiopian troops expired, one local Mogadishu resident, pharmacist and father Muhammad Noor, said the possible confrontation between the Islamist and Somalist neighbor Ethiopia would have a tremendous impact on the local population.
If the Ethiopians tried to make trouble in our country, we are ready to fight them and defend our country, and Allah willing, we shall win over them as Allah promised us. But as civilians, war affects us most in death, displacement, and lots of other bad things war brings. We hope for the best that the war could be averted.
There are fears that fighting between the Islamists and the government could involve the two rival neighbors of Ethiopia and Eritrea, who support the government and the Islamists respectively. Both countries are accused by the UN of having troops in Somalia, a charge they deny. Ilhan Ali, a young student, thinks the suffering she may face if the worst were ever to happen will be for the sake of her country.
I see the war between the courts and the government as a just war because we are defending our country against invasion from our enemy, Ethiopia. And I pray victory for the Islamic courts. But if war happens, we know people will suffer. But whatever happens to us this time, it is worth it.
Dahir Hassan, a nurse at Al Hikmah Hospital in Mogadishu, says the war would be short.
The war was forced on us by the Ethiopians, and whatever happens to us common people, it is the responsibility of the Ethiopians who have invaded our country. Anyway, the war will be short, and the Ethiopians and their stooges will be chased away.
Fears are on the rise in the Horn of Africa that a major conflict could erupt, affecting the region. For Free Speech Radio News in Mogadishu, I'm Abdurrahman Warsame.
The Supreme Court of Maryland has ordered a halt to all capital punishment in the state while the government reviews its execution procedures. This comes on the heels of a similar ruling late last week in the state of California. Florida also suspended executions last week after irregularities with a lethal injection there. 13 people were hanged in Iraq today for various crimes, including rape and murder. 64 people have been executed by the state since 2004, when the death penalty was reinstated in Iraq. Another 150 remain on death row. Meanwhile, Iraq's former electricity minister, Ayham al-Samadi, escaped jail from inside Baghdad's fortified Green Zone. This is the second time the ex-minister has escaped jail while serving a 2-year corruption sentence. FSRN's Salam Talib has the story.
Former electricity minister Ayham al-Samadi escaped from jail yesterday. Al-Samadi was being held at a prison under joint U.S.-Iraqi control in the heavily guarded Green Zone area in Baghdad. He was charged at 11th of October, 2 years in jail for corruption and missing about $200,000 from the ministry money. Iraqi Public Integrity Commissioner said al-Samadi fled with the help of members of a private security company.
The American military was guarding the jail, and the contractors who helped them, not the Iraqis.
Sermad Abdul Karim, a journalist in Iraq for All News website, made a report about corruptions in Iraqi government. He says the case was a political war between the different powers in Iraq and had nothing to do with corruption.
80% of the case is just political fighting. All the people that were supporting other politicians in the last government, they're now under attack by the other political powers.
Karim says that the Americans want to cover up the corruption of the Iraqi government because that can lead to the Americans themselves.
والله وارد جدا لانه يجوز هو هذا المبلغ اللي انا اعتقادي
The Americans have an interest in releasing him. He was the minister under Bremer. All of the contracts should be proofed by the Americans before paying any money to the contractors. They released Al-Samaria, so he could not say what he knew about the Americans' involvement and point the finger at them.
Ahmed Al-Ahmadi said from Diwaniya Human Rights Office, the Americans' involvement in releasing security detainees is not new. And he told us about what happened last September in Diwaniya.
Last time an armed group shot the people in front of El Sadr office in Diwaniya, they had a car accident later. The Iraqi military transferred them to the hospital and interrogated them. They said they were working for the Americans, but nobody believed them. A half hour later, the U.S. military raided the hospital and detained the interrogation officer and took the attackers with them.
Al-Ahmadi says Iraqi expectations of the Americans have changed after hearing and seeing these kind of actions.
We do not look at the Americans now as civilized people. We do not want them in Iraq as liberators, as scientists, or under any other name, because of the savageness and the barbaric actions that are connected with the American name. And I am really sorry for that.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Salam Talib.
Colombian President Alvaro Uribe has announced that he will push forward with Plan Colombia's coca eradication program in the south of the country, right up to its border with Ecuador. As Diletta Varlesi reports, Colombia is ignoring a bilateral agreement with Ecuador to respect a six-mile distance from the border to protect Ecuadorian farmers.
Since 2001, acid rain has showered the borderland between Ecuador and Colombia. It's a mix of chemical products made by strong pesticide with a high percentage of glyphosate, a component defined by the World Health Organization as highly risk to life. Plan Colombia, an agreement reached by the US and Colombia in 2001 as a strategy to fight narcotraffic and coca leaf cultivations, includes the use of glyphosate on the area where coca leaf cultivation is intense, spread by plants on villages, crops and animals. The so-called fumigation operation in Colombia is not supposed to cross the border with Ecuador, but it happens often. Adolfo Maldonado is a Spanish doctor with Acción Ecológica, an NGO that studies the impact of fumigation on the locals. He says the effects on the inhabitants, farmers and their cultivations are serious.
Nosotros hicimos un primer estudio, fue en el año 2001, en el cual comparamos cuáles eran los...
We made a first study in the year 2001, and we compared the symptoms shown by populations living at 2, 5, and 10 kilometers from the border. We found that main health problems are connected with breathing, digestion, skin, and eyes.
Problemas de piel y problemas de conjuntivas, prácticamente de ojos.
Ecuador has refused to enter Plan Colombia, and over a course of 5 years, thousands of farmers have demonstrated against the systematic violation of the border between Ecuador and Colombia. Acción Ecológica released a study for a year after Plan Colombia was implemented. It found that there was a high animal mortality rate and farmers lost 90% of their coffee crops and 80% of rice and corn. José Bone is a farmer suffering from an untreatable skin disease.
I was working in my field. It was very hot, and I went to the river to refresh myself when I immediately felt a strong itch all over my body. My son, in that moment, showed me a plane crossing over our heads and seemed to release a kind of smoke. After 2 hours, we went back home, and during the night, it was itching so strong that I could not stay still, and I felt like dying. Now, after almost 3 years, I've lost all my skin, and the new skin has no melanin. I can't work in the fields and stay in the sun anymore.
Dr. Maldonado says that this also affects the population psychologically, especially the children on the border.
Recogieron los dibujos de los niños y les pidieron que dibujaran familias. Nosotros comparamos los dibujos. Estos mismos niños habían hecho 5 años atrás cuando comenzó el periodo de...
Last year in schools, we made psychological tests with children's drawings, asking them to represent their families. We compared those drawings with the ones they drew 5 years ago, at the beginning of the fumigation. The results we got are really dramatic. What we found out is that children were forced not to express their feelings, and they hide stories of blood, death, and family violence. They were drawing people with no face, no expressions, when representing their own families.
Boca, expresión, en un momento en el que a ellos se les estaba pidiendo que dibujaran su propia familia.
In 2005, the Federation of Farmers on the Ecuadorian Border, or FENOCIN, obtained a bilateral agreement between Ecuador and Colombia to create a 10-kilometer safe zone to prevent Ecuadorian farms from being fumigated. Recently, Colombian President Álvaro Uribe declared he was not willing to respect the agreement anymore and would order fumigations in the safe zone. FENOCIN and other environmental organizations are organizing to put pressure on the new elected government of Rafael Correa to defend their life and territory. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese.
The outcry is growing in Australia over the failure by Queensland's Director of Public Prosecutions to charge and bring to trial a policeman implicated in the death of an Indigenous man from Palm Island. As SFSRN's Erica Voles reports, although Queensland's Premier, Peter Beattie, has travelled to Palm Island to consult with the community, many fear that the visit is too little, too late.
2 years ago, Aboriginal man Mulurunji Dumaji was found dead in his police cell an hour after being arrested for being drunk and disorderly. Solicitor representing the Dumaji family, Stuart Levitt, outlines what a subsequent coroner's report determined had caused his death.
Mulurunji suffered severe injuries which could have only been caused by the application of considerable force, and that's clear from the admissible medical expert evidence that his liver was effectively severed by a strong impact of his liver against his vertebrae, which virtually cut it in half, and he suffered 4 broken ribs and a black eye.
The Deputy State Coroner pointed to the actions of Chris Hurley, the police officer witnessed in close proximity to Mulurunji, as being the cause of the deceased's injuries. He was stood down on full pay, but he's now back in the job, following a decision by the Queensland Director of Public Prosecutions that Hurley has no case to answer. Lawyer Stuart Levitt outlines why he feels the DPP is wrong.
The directors of public prosecution said, firstly, that she considered other evidence which she failed to identify. Secondly, she said that there'd been contradictory evidence given. And thirdly, that she didn't hold with what the Deputy State Coroner had found as to the cause of death. And in fact, she gave a version of the death of Mulurunji, which was inconsistent with the testimony of Hurley himself.
Queensland Premier Peter Beattie is standing by the DPP decision. This week he dismissed the concerns of Aboriginal elders who pointed to inconsistencies between the coroner's findings and the DPP decision.
Really is important in all this. We actually understand the law. The standard of proof for a coroner actually sits down, goes through all the evidence and makes various findings. Those findings then have to be considered by the Director of Public Prosecution. So in other words, the coroner doesn't make the decision about who's charged or not, it's the Director of Public Prosecutions. And that is the process that has to be determined by what's admissible in a court of law.
But Solicitor Stuart Levitt maintains that the evidence should be put to a jury.
It's a matter for the DPP to leave the matter for a jury. That's the basis of our constitutional system of government, that the courts, constituted by juries of fact, in a situation where there's a presumption of innocence, preside over the determination of guilt or innocence and not executive appointees of the state government.
Stuart Levitt and others are calling for an independent review of the DPP's findings in order that the case be brought to trial. 2 years ago, Mulurunji's death led to riots on the island. There are now real concerns that if justice is not seen to be done, Indigenous Australians will only feel further alienated from the law, which could prompt some to take matters into their own hands. This is Erica Voles in Sydney, reporting for FSRN.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Ada Bogado.